Attention, attention all personnel. It's MASHcast.
Hello and welcome to MASHcast, the show that analyzes and celebrates episode by episode the greatest TV series of all time, MASH, which aired on CBS from 1972 to 1983. Proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network, I'm your host, General Robert Iron Guts Kelly, and joining us this week in the VIP tent is Captain Ted Kelvington. Hi, Ted. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Rob. Glad to be here.
I'm very excited. This is the first. We've been friends online for a long time. We've never podcasted before, so this is cool.
Glad to make my Fire and Water Network debut.
Wait a minute. You've never been on a Fire and Water Network show at all yet?
No, this will be my first.
Oh, my goodness. All right. Well, I'm glad. It's all downhill from here, Ted, I have to say. If any other shows you do, with the maybe Chris, but the rest, it's not going to live up. So, you know, let's enjoy this while we have this moment together. We're here to talk about from season four, episode three, It Happened One Night. The original air date was September 26, 1975. But before we get to the show, Ted, I got to ask you, how did you become a fan of MASH the series?
Well, when I was a kid, my parents watched it and, you know, did the original episodes when they were showing for the first time. And then when it started going into syndication, was right around the same time my parents divorced. And I went from being a MASH watcher to a MASH fanatic, and watching it two, three times a day.
I mean, what was it about, you know, what was it that appealed to you as a kid? We've gone over this in previous episodes. It's like for a show set in the past and seemingly about things that kids can't relate to, it had a very large, you know, kid audience.
Well, definitely it's kind of the rebellion against authority.
Right, right, right.
Certainly got to be the kid appeal there. That and watching Klinger in his outfits certainly is the kid appeal.
So when you got older and you caught it in reruns, did you like say, oh, that's what that reference is? You know, when they're talking about Eisenhower, I now know what that means. You sort of caught up with it.
Right, right. Even though I first watched the show when I was, I don't know, we'll say 8 or 9, it wasn't until I was about 12 that I realized there was actually was a Korean War. That wasn't something they just made up for TV.
You thought that was just a made-up war that they were fighting in?
I mean, I heard of the Vietnam War, and I thought it was just kind of maybe some, you know, allegory like Metropolis or something like that.
Wow. I mean, geez, that's sort of funny you say that, because in some circles, the Korean War is called the Forgotten War. And there it is. You know, that says something that it wasn't. I mean, obviously, even the youngest child from my, you know, I grew up in the 70s, I heard of World War II. Everybody heard of World War II. And, of course, if you've heard of World War II, you've heard of World War I because of the sequel naming. And everyone was familiar with the Vietnam War. The Vietnam War was still going when I was alive. So that's funny because it's sort of kid logic. But at the same time, it really seems to indicate that idea that the Korean War was the forgotten war has some real relevance, because you were a kid, you weren't even familiar with it.
Definitely, definitely. You know, it was a police action, as frequently point out on the show. And I don't know at the time if they actually called it the Korean War. You know, certainly Vietnam was called a war while we were fighting it, but I don't know how the general public perceived the Korean War at the time.
Hmm. Police action. What a bunch of Orwellian nonsense that is. Police action. What are we talking about? It's as they said on the show, it's a war, everybody. All right. Well, that's marvelous. As I said, we're here to talk about season four, episode three, It Happened One Night. It aired on September 26th, 1975. It's written by Larry Gelbart and Simon Muntner and Gene Reynolds, and directed by Gene Reynolds. It's cold, cold, cold outside as we see a change in shifts at the hospital. BJ is just finishing up with Hawkeye coming on around midnight. Unfortunately, the relative quiet is shattered when bombs start falling nearby, causing one of the patients to start thrashing and screaming, almost pulling out his stitches in the progress. Margaret gives Frank a sexy note to say goodbye, but she is shocked to see he tears it up after he reads it. He reveals to her he has left no written trace of their relationship, and Frank seems worried when Margaret reveals she's kept everything he has written her. Everything? Frank asks nervously. The shelling eventually gets so bad, Radar wakes up Colonel Potter so he can order the nearby artillery unit to move further down the road and give the 477 some peace and quiet. Meanwhile, a soldier on guard duty, a kid barely 18, accidentally fires his gun at nipping Klinger in the arm, which of course he tries to turn into a major injury. Now my arms have blown off. There's a period of quiet, but then the bombs start falling again, and Colonel Potter goes further up the chain of command, which seems to work, only for the bombs to start falling all over again a few minutes later, causing Potter to spill hot coffee in his lap and curse the heavens. One patient in BJ's continues to go south, so he has to go back in and operate on him again, while Hawkeye and Margaret try to contain the other patient who is still having trouble staying calm. He even bites Hawkeye in the process. Finally, near dawn, the bombs stop. BJ saves his patient, and the other patient in post-op is sedated so he can finally get some rest. Soon after, Margaret goes back to her tent, only to find an unconscious Frank who tore her place apart, searching for all of his incriminating love notes. All right. So, Ted, before we get into this episode, I want to ask you, like, what is your particular favorite era of MASH? Is it these seasons? Is it the Trapper Henry era? Is it later? I mean, what's your sweet spot on MASH?
Oh, it's definitely seasons 4 through 7, when we had the overlap with Colonel Potter and Radar. They were a great pair there, and that was certainly that's also when Ken Levine was one of the writers, and mm-hmm. He certainly had a really good run of episodes, and of course he went on to do Cheers and Frasier mm-hmm. and other shows. So yeah, seasons 4 through 7 were definitely my favorites.
So regarding this episode, I mean, obviously after the tumultuous change brought onto the show in the first two episodes, Welcome to Korea, Change of Command, with you've got new characters coming in. Here, this is where MASH is sort of reverting to the mean, where it's like, okay, we've brought in the new characters, we've done all that setup, so now let's just tell a sort of regular episode of MASH, which is what goes on overnight in the OR and in the post-op. And then, of course, in the ancillary tents and things like that. But it's a smaller episode after the ambitious first two episodes of the season of, all right, now we've introduced Potter, we've introduced BJ, now we're going to see how these characters interrelate. And, you know, MASH, for the most part, I think could be run out of order. I know in syndication, they certainly ran them out of order. And you really wouldn't, other than characters disappearing or looking, you know, Hawkeye's, BJ's mustache and here and there, you really probably wouldn't be able to tell within any given season what order they were running in. But this is one of those ones where you kind of can't tell, because obviously Colonel Potter is still brand new, and he is not the warm-hearted Colonel Potter that we would come to know. He's kind of short with Radar here and there. Like, he's much more blustery. The scene where Radar wakes him up to get him to move the artillery, and he's like, he's like, Colonel Captain Pierce, I ask you to do something about it, sir. And he's like, and? Like, he kind of yells at Radar a little bit. And that's not something Colonel Potter would do, like, in just a couple of episodes. They would sort of write that out of the character. But here, he's still pretty new. And there's some new stuff about BJ we'll get to as well. Before we get to all that, though, I got to ask you, Ted, if you're wondering about this, that I do. I could never keep track of how the seasons fall in MASH. Because in the previous episode, it's warm enough that Radar is sunning himself with, as Colonel Potter calls it, the shiny cardboard. He's yep. shirtless out on the compound. And in the very next episode, it's practically winter here. So, like, where is Korea? Is it on the Genesis planet? I mean, how does this work?
Exactly. That was my very first note. And I don't know if maybe it was shown out of sequence on the first run, or if they just didn't pay any attention to that kind of thing. Because I'd have to imagine, when they were producing the episodes, that you would, since some of the show episodes were shot outdoors at the location on the 20th Century Fox Ranch,
right?
Some of them were done on a soundstage. I'd have to imagine you'd want to do all of the outdoor scenes bundled together as you're producing them, and save the interior scenes for later on. And of course, this episode, there were some outdoor scenes, but they certainly could have been on a soundstage, because it was night, so you didn't have to have any, you know, the mountains in the background or anything like that.
Right. I mean, on a production scale, it makes sense to do that all at once. But then very next episode, it'll still be winter, so at least that's consistent. But this is always, to me, one of the biggest change-ups that in just, you know, the very previous show, it's really warm enough to do sunbathing, and now here everybody is freezing, which is like, oh, okay, all right. Actor-wise, the first guest star we see is Darren O'Connor. He plays Jenkins, the young kid. He has very few credits. He was in a movie called Hollywood, a TV show called Hollywood High. He only has a handful of credits other than this. Again, I always wonder, how does somebody in like practically their first acting job in front of a camera end up on MASH? That kind of seems like starting at the top. You would think that somebody, you would see somebody get a bunch of credits, little bits and pieces here and there, and then they land a MASH. But this kid landed MASH like as his second ever credit. And then he did two more things and then he disappeared again. I always wonder, how do Hollywood careers work like?
Yeah, it's definitely interesting. He had some other connection to the show. Maybe he was a writer or a son of a producer or something like that.
right.
You know, definitely had to have an in. I mean, Ron Howard was on Andy Griffith's show for several seasons, and he had about the same size role as Jenkins did.
Yep. Yeah, that's right. So after the initial scene where BJ comes back from post-op, they have the great gag about where he tries to get a swig of coffee and no coffee comes out, and he opens it up and there's a golf ball inside the canteen, and Hawkeye's like, "You gonna have it?" And BJ says, "No, I have one golf ball and I'm up all night." And Klinger radar drags Hawkeye out, and then he has to go and he has to round up Margaret because it's her, she's on duty as well. And I love all the setup of that, that Margaret's got her laundry hanging across various lines in her tent, and radar kind of like wafts through her pantyhose and her dresses. And then he knows he has to physically touch her to wake her up. And he knows, of course, he's probably been through this where he's terrified. He actually puts on a glove just to touch her, just to gently kind of poke her a little, because he's going to know that probably A, his hands are probably cold, and B, he probably figures that Margaret is going to think that he's a pervert by touching him flesh to flesh or something. And she reacts that way anyway. She screams at him, "How dare you paw me?" And it's like, what am I supposed to do? It's like, you know, and it's, you know, she's always thinking everyone in the camp has got googly eyes for her.
Yeah. And to be fair, when the male to female ratio there is so limited, probably the majority of the men did have googly eyes for her.
That's true. I don't think Radar did.
Radar wasn't developed enough for that kind of thing.
No, there's an episode later on this season where Klinger talks about that he had a dream about Margaret Major Houlihan, and BJ says, "You want to marry Major Houlihan?" And Klinger goes, "Lech." Like, so that's another one that Klinger, you know, Klinger doesn't find Margaret attractive. But yeah, you're right. Probably most of the rest of the camp does. So then Hawkeye and Margaret show up to post-op, and Frank, of course, chides Hawkeye for being like 2 minutes late, and then Margaret walks in 2 minutes late, and he's completely fine with it, and he gives them a tour of all the patients, and we meet a patient named Abbott, played by Christopher Alport. He's the one who is clearly got some PTSD going on, or maybe not post-traumatic. He's in the middle of it. He's in the middle of the war where he warns Hawkeye and Margaret, like, "Don't look at me, don't touch me." He has a lot of credits. He was in shows like Dynasty, Felicity, Days of Our Lives. He passed away in 2008, relatively young. But Hawkeye tries to calm him down and say, you know, look, we're all trying to have a, you know, we all want to have a quiet night. And then you've got Frank being the typical Frank where he says, you know, we're all dealing with the war, so shut your yap, and which is, you know, a wonderful thing for a doctor to say to you.
Yeah. Now, one of the things that makes me a bit more of an expert on the subject than a lot of, or if not most of your other guests, is when I was 17, I joined the Air Force and I was assigned to be a medic.
Oh, so, wow. I didn't know that. Oh, that's marvelous.
Yeah. So I actually did spend 3.5 years as a military medic. Now it was in peacetime, and of course, you know, the way the Air Force did things in the late 80s in peacetime is obviously not the same as the Army would do things during war in 52 or whatever year this was, but certainly there are also a lot of similarities. So I've met my share of doctors who had really bad bedside manners.
Wow. Oh, that's, geez. Okay. Oh, that's horrifying to think that that's, you know, real life. I guess it's realistic, but that's sad to think. So may I ask, what was it about the Air Force that was so appealing?
Well, I had a couple of relatives that had joined the Army, and they didn't like it. But I wasn't ready to go to college right out of high school. So I definitely needed a break. And then when the recruiter came to school, I was like, well, get the GI Bill, make some money, see the world, you know, take some time off of school. And all of that really appealed to me. So that's what I did. And within 6 months after graduating high school, I was stationed in Germany.
Wow. Where else did you go?
We did about 4 months of training in Texas, and then 2 years in Germany, and I spent the rest of my time in Biloxi, Mississippi.
Oh, okay. What did you think of Germany?
Oh, loved it. Certainly there were a lot of things about my time in the service that I didn't enjoy, but I would do it all over again just for the opportunity as, you know, a teenager to go spend a couple of years in Europe. That was fantastic.
What an amazing experience for a young man like that. That's, I mean, right out of high school, all of a sudden you're in Germany. That had to be pretty amazing.
Yeah, and you mentioned earlier how Jenkins, in this episode, was barely 18. I joined in June of 86, and I turned 18 in September of 86.
Wow.
I arrived overseas in November. So it was like literally 10 weeks after I turned 18 before I was deployed overseas.
Wow. Oh, my goodness. Now, it's funny. The previous episode that we just did, Change of Command, I did with Joe Price, who is a retired Army major. And I commented that was our first episode with a veteran talking about MASH. And now we've had two. We're doing two right in a row. So I had no idea that was your background. That's pretty amazing. That's a brave thing for a 17-year-old to do.
Yeah, you know, when I was a kid, certainly at that time, I didn't realize just how brave it was. It was kind of like, you know, I had no idea how deep this water is. I'll just jump into it.
Right,
you know?
Right.
You're 17. You do a lot of things without thinking about it.
Oh, yeah. Yep. So this regarding, again, this episode, we're in the middle of the scene in the post-op. There's one of the other patients is a Chinese soldier, and I love Frank's paranoia where he whispers to Hawkeye, "He's Chinese," and Hawkeye's like, "I think he knows he's Chinese, Frank." And we see that this guy has like two broken arms, a broken leg, a broken, like several broken ribs, and he says to Margaret, "Do you want me to put a guard on him?" And I love Alan Alda's reaction where he kind of gets this incredibly annoyed, "Oh, come on, Frank!" Like he's just like. But this guy couldn't do anything. He says, this guy couldn't break the 5-hour mile or whatever it is. For God's sakes, Frank, put the paranoia aside for 5 minutes.
Yeah. Frank certainly played it up way too much.
Yeah. And Margaret, at least, is like, I think I'm okay, Major. As he departs, he has a line to them where he says, Captain and Major, I'll leave you two to carry on. And that is a reference to I think we've mentioned this in other episodes too. This is a reference to the British Carry On series of films, which were these sort of slightly blue, off-color comedies. Sometimes they were sex comedies or like nudist comedies. And the phrase carry on, I think in British parlance, means basically to have sex. And that was kind of the cute way of referring to it. In America, that phrase has no currency. At all. So right. When I was a kid and I watched this episode and he would say, I would leave you two to carry on, they would have the laugh track, hit the laugh button, and I didn't get it. You know, I was like, why is that funny? I don't know what that means. And then later on, after I started hearing about these movies, I was like, oh, okay, in the 1950s, that phrase was something that was commonly said and was obviously a malapropism on Frank's part. But that was, again, that was one of those jokes that just sailed over my head up until I became an adult.
Yeah, and it's actually, it's a fairly common phrase, you know, it just means keep on doing what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
I certainly didn't realize any innuendo about it when I was a kid.
I have not seen any of the Carry On movies. I've never seen any. I've never got around to it. I mean, of course, in season two, there was Carry On Hawkeye. To the title of that episode. So obviously it's a phrase that they've used a bit here and there. So then the bombs start falling. Hawkeye tries to get radar to call the shelling off because they realize that it is American shelling that's causing all the racket. And we have one of the classic sort of Bob Newhart style phone conversations where we only hear one side of it, and Radar is talking to somebody, some military guy somewhere, trying to get him to stop the bombing runs, and he and Hawkeye is there, and there's the reads of that great run where he says, what does he say? And he says that he has a suggestion, but I think it's physically impossible. And then Hawkeye takes the call, and he demands that the guy do it, and the guy basically tells Hawkeye to go pound sand, and Hawkeye has that great line where Radar says, what did he say? And he says, you're right, Radar, he's got a lot to learn about anatomy, which is, I love jokes that you have to put together yourself, that they don't hand out everything to. So I love the idea that it's up to your imagination to imagine what filthy thing this guy said to both Radar and Hawkeye when they told him to stop shooting off the artillery.
And of course, they're up a few moments later in the episode. There's another great kind of a mental visual, which is they describe something to you. They don't even give you a full description, but they give you enough to make a really hilarious visual in your mind.
Right.
And, I'm talking about when Colonel Potter is talking to the general, and the general apparently wants some type of medical advice, for which Colonel Potter advises him to soak in his helmet. And of course, you know, there's only two possible, maybe three possible things that he would want to soak, one being a foot, one being a hand, and the other being the back of his front.
Right. How would one even put their entire backside into a helmet? I mean, I don't even understand how that would fit.
It wouldn't. I've worn military helmets, I can tell you it wouldn't fit. But just the he didn't, you know, he doesn't actually say, you know, stick this body part, he doesn't mention a body part, but just the visual you get of someone trying to, even if you think if it's a foot, trying to stick a foot in a helmet and soaking in it, it's just a really funny visual.
Gary Berghoff is great in the background listening to this, kind of like, what? And he kind of knows he probably shouldn't be hearing this conversation, but it's too late to leave the office at that point. So he's just kind of like, oh my God, okay. So Hawkeye tells Radar to go get Colonel Potter. He gets accosted by the young sentry duty. I love that whole bit about where he's like, did you give him the password? He didn't ask, the dumb kid. I love that Radar is, of course, he's probably, you know, barely 6 months older than this kid, but he's got a lot of experience. So to him, this little freckle-faced kid is the dumb kid, which I think is a nice ongoing gag.
Yeah. I remember I was in about 3 years, and I overheard a conversation between some trainees, one of whom had been in for 1 year, and the other one had been in for 6 months, and the guy who was in for 1 year was lording it all over the 6 month guy about how much more he knew.
Those 6 months can really make a difference.
Apparently, yeah.
So then after this, Frank gets the idea that he is going to sneak into Margaret's tent and look for her love notes. And, you know, it's kind of a funny thing in that if you're with somebody, first of all, Frank's being a jerk. I mean, he just is. But of course, and we know that the reason that he is worried about all this is because he doesn't want his wife to find out. It's not for any other reason other than that. Now, I will say I have been in relationships, some lasting longer than others. And there does get to be a point where if you are in a relationship with somebody long enough and they keep giving you, you know, cards or notes, eventually you do have to kind of wonder, am I supposed to hold on to all of these? Because it can pile up after a while.
Yeah. And I know just whether it's Christmas cards or birthday cards, I tend to hang on. And then, you know, you move around. And by the time I'm 40, I've got several hundred cards. And my wife is like, why do you keep all those cards? I'm like, well, they send them to me. You know, I understand the notion of keeping that stuff. Certainly if it's someone meaningful to you. So I can understand why Margaret might do it. But Frank certainly, again, with his paranoia, like his wife is going to find a scrap of paper in Korea.
I love that Frank tears it up the minute he's done reading it. Like, he doesn't even wait like a day or two. I mean, I've held on, like you said, I've held on to Christmas cards or birthday cards. And then after a month or so, you know, I would go and I put them in recycling or something like that. But I mean, Frank reads the note and literally tears it up right afterwards, which is like, geez, he couldn't have waited a little bit to hold on to put it in his pocket, walk away. But he, of course, he doesn't realize that Margaret is watching him. So then Radar finally gets to Potter's tent, and there's a great detail here. I love that he wakes Potter up. Potter hears the artillery go off and just goes, "It's ours," and puts his head back on the pillow as if nothing to worry about. First of all, I love that because that's a completely different take on what we would have gotten from Henry Blake. And B, I love that simply by hearing it, he can tell that it's U.S. artillery. I have no idea how he could know that, but obviously Colonel Potter is sensitive enough that he can figure out what that sounds like.
Yeah, well, certainly being in the military, at that point he'd been in since World War One, he had enough experience with the different sounds of war and military that he might very well recognize the difference between American shelling and foreign or enemy shelling.
I mean, is there really a difference? Are the cannons different in a way that you could tell just by ear that they're American? It seems amazing. I mean, are there that? It sounds ignorant, but I don't know this stuff. Is there that many variations in the kind of artillery in 1952 or one that you could tell like that?
Well, it's certainly possible that the type of ordnance the Americans used was different from the type. I think at this point they were only fighting North Koreans, and I don't know if the Chinese had entered by this episode or not.
No.
But yeah, there was certainly certainly could be a difference in ordnance, you know, that might be noticeable to someone who'd been in for a while. The other thing that occurred to me, though, was also maybe Colonel Potter had been forewarned, you know, he'd gotten a briefing or a memo or something like that saying, oh, by the way, in the, you know, 1 mile north of Weijambu, there's going to be shelling on this night or something like that.
Oh, that's true. I didn't think of it that. He's right. He's probably gets inside information that he doesn't necessarily think he needs to share it with everybody. Yeah, I didn't even consider that. So after Colonel Potter has the phone call with one of the generals, and he tells him, and then they hear a gunshot. And they look off and they realize that the young kid has accidentally shot Klinger. And of course, Klinger is going to milk that for the best he can. And he comes into post op and he's in the death throes where he's calling out to all of his dead relatives, Uncle Frieda and Uncle Harry, or Uncle Harry and Frieda. And he's going on and on and on. And I love that Hawkeye is trying to examine him and he's like, was the gun even loaded? Like, he can't tell. It's like, could you bleed at all? Like, and then they finally put him in the bed, and he has this Hawkeye has this weird line where he goes, he's molting, which is like, I guess there's like residue or something on his coat. But I mean, I love that he is, of course, Klinger is playing it to the absolute hilt, even though the wound, as we'll find out, is next to nothing. Syndication wise, I always found it interesting in the scene, the act break in syndication. The line ends with Hawkeye saying he's molting, and then it cuts to commercial. But in the versions of the full episodes on DVD or on Hulu or whatever, Margaret gets a line. You hear her say, "Come on, Klinger," and that's the final scene. And I thought, wow, when they edited these in syndication, they were slicing the salami that fine that they were cutting 3 seconds out of an episode. I mean, that's I always thought that from what I've seen, that the syndicated edits were a little on the clumsier side. You could sort of tell when they edited things because there would be like sound distortions or whatever. But geez, I thought was this episode of MASH, I guess, was like 3 seconds too long. And so that line had to come out. It's very odd to me.
Yeah. It definitely is weird. And of course, I watched every episode when they were in syndication in the 80s. And then by the time I got out of the military in 1990, it wasn't showing as much in syndication. And so I didn't really watch it in the 90s or in the aughts. But then earlier in the teens, when they started streaming service, I started watching it again. And it was just amazing. And I can't remember, you know, like, did I remember it wrong? Or, you know, which bits were in before and which bits weren't? Mm-hmm. So, you know, it was definitely one of those things, because there are some things I swore, it was like, I never saw this scene before.
Right.
I might very well not have seen, you know, a scene before.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. So when I watched them all for the first time on the DVDs, it was like, wow, I'm getting a good 10% of new MASH content that I'd never seen before. This was all these scenes. It was marvelous.
The director's cut.
Yeah, right. Exactly. The director's cut. By the way, I've mentioned this in other episodes as well. There have to be deleted MASH scenes, right? There have to be.
Yeah.
They shot 251 episodes. Why isn't that material available? I'd love to see. I mean, and I don't mean outtakes or bloopers. Those we've seen. But, like, there must be trims here and there of episodes that ran a little long or the edit ran a little long. Like, I'd love to see that material. That's got to be sitting around. So, I mean, it's got to be – it's technically now in a Disney vault because Disney owns Fox. But that material has got to be around at least in some regard.
I don't know if it had occurred to me before that MASH was owned by Disney via Fox. So would that make Klinger a Disney princess?
Klinger is officially a Disney princess at this point. I hope that they find a way to market MASH as successfully as they do some of their other properties now. I would love to see that. I mean, if The Simpsons can be now considered family entertainment to be put on Disney Plus in full, all 400 seasons that they've done of that show. And, you know, for some of you that are listening to this, you're not old enough to remember that when The Simpsons was originally airing, it was considered dangerous television. It seems absurd now, but it was considered dangerous television. I mean, we had a first lady speak out against it. It was considered such, you know, almost dangerous to the American institution of the family. And now it's family entertainment. It's on Disney Plus. So if The Simpsons can convert it over the time, MASH can too. So I know that they're keeping a lot of their Fox material off of Disney Plus, and nobody seems to know yet where that material is all going to go. But Disney owns MASH, so they could do something. Disney the animated MASH the animated series. Come on, Disney, do something with this.
Well, there you go. And then, of course, are we going to see a crisis on Disney universes where we have all the different properties that they've acquired over the years, you know, get together?
Why not? Hey, you know, MASH Endgame or something. I don't know. We can figure it out. So they got the money. So coming back from commercial, Hawkeye is bandaging up Radar Klinger, and he's saying it's barely even a scratch. Klinger, again, is just playing it up. He talks about that he's losing sensation in his hands. And he has a line where he says, "I think I got what Betty Davis had in Mrs. Skeffington." And at the time, you know, I knew who Betty Davis was. I'd never heard of Mrs. Skeffington. And I just assumed, oh, it must be an old movie. And then at some point in the 90s, pre-internet, but to the point where I had already worked at a video store, we had the film Mr. Skeffington with Betty Davis. And I got to tell you, because I was so sure MASH got these things correct, which we now know that they didn't. But for the longest time, I was sure because Klinger said Mrs. Skeffington that there was a sequel called there was Mr. Skeffington. And then I guess they did a second film, Mrs. Skeffington. I was so sure of that because I'm like, MASH would not steer me wrong. Turns out that no, there is no Mrs. Skeffington. The film is Mr. Skeffington. So Klinger's making the error, and the writer is making the error. But for the longest time, I took that as gospel, that there must be some second film in the Skeffington series that I've never heard of.
Well, the way I read it was that Klinger just said, I have what Mrs. Skeffington had. In other words, the
character. Oh, I see. He's referring to the character, not the title of the movie.
Right, right.
Okay, all right. Well, maybe so.
Yeah, I looked it up, and apparently the character Mrs. Skeffington had was diphtheria.
Okay. Klinger thinks he has diphtheria from a, he even says it could have been a rusty bullet. And Hawkeye's like, nah, come on. So Potter gets woken up again. He crosses the compound. He gets accosted by the young soldier. Potter has a nice moment where he says to the kid, "Are you scared?" And he goes, "No, just cold, sir." And Potter leans in and he says, "If you had any brains, you'd be scared," which is great. That's exactly the kind of commander that you want.
Definitely, yeah.
And Radar gives him, again, the dirty eye. Radar does not like this kid. He's doing the six-month thing. He's lording it over this guy. So then Potter goes again and tries to does the whole, "Your big guns of yours are ratting on our bedpans." He does that whole thing. "I got some pretty sick boys on my hospital. It's not doing them much good either." And he's trying his best. You know, he's trying his best to – I'm guessing that if you're running an artillery barrage, you're not that concerned about some colonel calling you and telling you that this is a bother. But at the same time, you know, presumably we're all on the same team here.
Yeah, yeah. But also, I'm guessing if it's a general, he's probably not actually at the artillery place. It's probably one of his subordinates, the colonel or whoever that's on site. So he went to the colonel's boss, who's probably back in Seoul or wherever. And he's like, oh, yeah, yeah, I heard about that. Oh, yeah, it's no big deal.
Who cares what these what the bunch of drafty doctors say? I don't care about that.
Right.
So back in post-op, Hawkeye and BJ have a conversation about this patient of BJ's that seems to be going south. And there's a nice – I don't think they really developed this too much. But when you watch MASH obsessively like we do, you start noticing things is that BJ is sure – that he patched all the holes, and he even has a line where he says there were 18 holes. I got all of them. I remember thinking, what a weird place for a golf course. And Hawkeye has a line. Well, maybe he sprung a new leak, and BJ just kind of blows past that and says, I got 18 holes. And it's BJ is fresh out of residency and he's full of pride, and he probably doesn't understand fully yet what this meatball surgery is going to be about. He thinks, once he's performed surgery on this guy and he's plugged all the holes, that's it. The guy is going to be fine at this point on. And it's Hawkeye is the one saying, look, he might have sprung a new leak or you might have made a mistake. And so there's this kind of BJ's got some pride going on here. He doesn't say it, but I feel like the way that Mike Farrell plays it, that BJ is sort of like, you know, not saying to Hawkeye, don't question me, but he's sure that he's done the everything he could do, and he's going to have to learn that might not be enough, that something else might happen. But I like that little moment. I mean, BJ would eventually get up to speed very quickly. But here, he's still a little like, oh, no, the guy's fine. And Hawker's like, the guy's not fine. He's getting worse. And I like that little detail. It's a nice reminder that, hey, BJ's brand new too.
Right, right. BJ's the doctor equivalent of Jenkins in this episode.
Yeah. You dumb kid. So, yeah.
A more experienced doctor wouldn't have, like Hawkeye, wouldn't have had to question. I mean, okay, the guy is having, what they say, 10 pints of blood at that point?
Something like that, a lot, yeah.
Yeah, and the human body, I think, only holds like 16 pints or something. Oof. Like that. Wow. So, you don't have to even be a doctor. I mean, I'm sure Margaret, any of the nurses there could have figured out that blood has to be going somewhere.
Yep.
So the most obvious thing is that he's bleeding. And if it's not bleeding out, it's bleeding in.
Right. All right. And then Klinger interrupts by coming in, freezing to death, having stripped almost down to, well, just his boxer shorts. Out in the frigid winter because he wants to get pneumonia. As he says, pneumonia, double pneumonia, Halsey, palsy, the plague. He'll do anything to get sick. Margaret has absolutely no time for this. And there's a bunch of screaming. And the patient we mentioned earlier, Abbott, tells them to shut up. And Klinger rails back, you shut up. And Margaret says, you both shut up. And then we have BJ just says one of my favorite jokes of the episode, welcome to one man's family. And again, that was a joke at the time I didn't get. I didn't know what one man's family was. I could get from the context of the joke that it was some sort of piece of entertainment and just the idea that this is your family of a bunch of people screaming at each other. Only now do I know One Man's Family was a radio show, the longest running dramatic radio show in radio history. It ran from 1932 to 1959, 27 seasons.
Wow.
Which is extraordinary. Yeah. And you could see why BJ would know it because it was a preeminent radio show at the time.
Yeah, yeah. And I love that line, you both shut up. I mean the frustration in Margaret's voice, and it's also amazing how she could go from being, commander of the nurses to being just another frustrated worker there in the ward or the unit. Was interesting, but yeah, her frustration there was pretty funny. You both shut up.
Yeah, Loretta Swick could really get some volume too with her voice. She could really, you both shut up. She could really,
yeah.
Let it rip when she needed to. So again, Colonel Potter talks to the final general, and that's the whole soak in your helmet bit. he does all that, and then back in post-op, we see that the patient is continuing to go downhill, and BJ finally accepts that, we're gonna have to go back in and they realize, well, they're going to need blood. And that's when Klinger finally decides to stop being Klinger, or stop being the sort of bad version of Klinger, where he says, don't wake anybody up, I've got that blood type, which would start the beginning of Klinger having, I think, four or five different blood types across MASH. Whenever they needed Klinger to have a particular blood type, he had it, even though it doesn't match, because I think they say he has AB negative, and then later on he's got the same blood as Winchester, who doesn't have AB negative. But Klinger gets out of his bed, gets out of his cot, and helps BJ load the patient onto a stretcher. And then we see, as Hawkeye and Margaret are dealing with Abbott, who is thrashing around thanks to the explosions, Klinger leaves the post op with BJ, and he's helping him out. And instead, Klinger is willing to pull a bunch of scams, even though he knows nobody's falling for it, and they know that he knows they're not falling for it. But when it's finally sort of clutch time, he'll do what he needs to do. And I like that that's sort of outside of the moment where he talks about the blood, I like that it's just unspoken. He gets up and he helps out because that's who he is.
Yeah, and I can say from my military experience that in stressful situations, a lot of times some of the usual decorum can be overlooked, you know, because they understand that people need a release. And so they might wear a non-military coat over their uniform when it's cold out or something like that. But the important thing is, can they count on him when they need him? And they can. Mm-hmm. You know, if they need Klinger, they can count.
Well, how in your mind? Well, how was that in the Air Force? Was there a lot of? I have nothing to compare it to, but in your mind, like, was there a lot of room soldiers were given for sort of personal expression or whatever, or was it fairly buttoned down as military outfits go?
It was fairly buttoned down, although, since I was a medic, sometimes depending on where we worked in the hospital, we would wear scrubs. So I did a rotation on the labor and delivery unit. So now I know where babies come from.
You'll have to let me know off air.
Sure. While we were there, we would all wear scrubs. So there are times when we would just walk to the hospital, the military hospital, in our civilian clothes, and then change into scrubs when we got there. And then, you know, do our shift and then leave, change back into our civilian clothes and leave. So we might never wear a uniform the whole time we're on duty.
Wow. Okay, oh, that's geez. I don't want to get too far off of this episode, but I am curious about your experience as a medic. I mean, how did you know you had the stomach for that? I would imagine for some people that's pretty grisly work, especially coming at it as when you did. You're such a young person.
Well, I didn't pick a job before I went in, which I often say is the single biggest mistake I've ever made in my entire life. And so because I didn't pick a job, they could give me anything that they wanted to. And after one day on the rifle range, they said, we need to give this guy a job that keeps him away from rifles. And since I had the aptitude scores and for to be a medic, and they needed medics, and they didn't want to retrain me on how to use a rifle. So a medic I became.
Okay. That's good. Were you hitting low flying planes and stuff with your rifle?
Well, out of a possible score of 400 on the rifle range, I scored, I think, like 78.
That sounds bad, is it? I don't have a frame of reference, but it doesn't sound good.
It's not really that bad when you consider I had never fired a rifle before that day.
Okay. Oh, wow. Okay. All right.
So, and I think a lot of it was also, they had just given me my new military glasses, and I was still getting used to that prescription. And I honestly think if I'd had a couple more days, like the second time I ever fired a rifle, which was a year and a half later, I more than doubled my score.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So it was just, yeah, I mean, you never fired a rifle before, wasn't used to using the sights, had a brand new pair of glasses, and I just, it was the first day, you know?
Yeah.
But, on the other hand, I can certainly see why, especially given my age, they might say, well, we don't want to put this kid in a job where he'll have any type of serious conflict. Not that the Air Force does, but.
Right. How did you take to the medic work? I mean, again, some people just I imagine don't have the, it's got to be tough work for some people if blood and that kind of stuff is really upsetting.
I just learned to put it out. It was just something I had to get used to. And of course it really certainly helped that it wasn't, you have to have that kind of detachment from the people you're working with. And sure. So you don't see them, you know, like if I would see a loved one, go through an injury, then of course, you know, you get really emotional. But if it's a stranger going through something, you can better detach yourself from that kind of thing.
Gotcha.
I remember, when I was in, I think it was ninth grade, they showed us a video or a film of a woman in childbirth, and I almost passed out. And then like 5 years later, I'm actually, you know, in a delivery room multiple times, help assisting with deliveries. So it was, you know, you learn to do it.
Trial by fire, I guess.
Right.
Wow.
Right.
Okay. All right. So, okay, back to post-op. We have the patient is thrashing around, and while Margaret is getting a sedative, Hawkeye has this great bit where he's trying to sedate the guy, but he's trying to get the guy calm. And but of course, he's not trying to hurt the guy because the guy's got he's got his arms in like splints and stuff. And then I love Alan Alda's read when he's like, he's biting me. He's biting Margaret. He's trying Margaret. He's biting me. He's doing his best not to scream because he doesn't want to upset the other patients. He doesn't want to upset the guy. But he's also trying to convey to Margaret, please go faster with whatever it is you're doing. And yeah. I just sort of love the low-key way that Alan Alda delivers it. He's biting me. That makes me laugh every time. And then Margaret gets up the needle, and then he finally screams, wait, get the right rump, because he needs to make sure that Margaret puts the needle in the right location.
Yeah, it reminded me of one time we had a patient who was in a coma and we needed to do a spinal tap on her. So we got a couple of us medics around to maneuver the body in place so the surgeon could do the spinal tap. And one of my colleagues over there, he starts insisting that the comatose patient is feeling him up. The hand slipped somewhere, and he's like, "She's feeling me up. She's feeling me up." And I'm like, "Norm, she's comatose." No.
All right, then. Well, the things that happen here. Yeah. So the button on the scene is we hear that the shelling is finally stopped, and you know, everything seems like we're finally going to be going back to normal. And then we cut to a can of beans that had been sitting on the wood fire stove, and obviously the pressure of the fire got them to explode, and the top comes off and sprays the post off with beans, and we get Margaret and Hawkeye with beans on their face, and he kind of runs his finger along her cheek and scrapes some of them off. It's not, MASH didn't do a lot of jokes like that. I mean, they did some physical comedy, but they generally didn't do that kind of stuff, like very broad jokes like that. And I think it's okay. It feels like, I guess they felt like it needed a joke to end the scene. I do wish that they had maybe layered that in, that you had seen, I don't know, maybe would have been, you know, too much, but maybe seeing the beans sitting there earlier or something. It sort of, to me, it's a little kind of comes out of nowhere that there's a can of beans sitting in the post-op and all of a sudden they explode. But again, they probably didn't need a way just to get out of the scene.
Yeah, the entire episode struck me as being more slice of life than plot-driven.
Yeah. Yep.
Just that, I mean, a lot of the activities of the different characters had no necessary connection to any of the other activities. You know,
right.
What Frank was doing was totally separate from what, you know, Colonel Potter was doing. And, of course, a lot of the characters never even had scenes with each other.
Right. Yeah, right. Potter and Radar interacts with Hawkeye, but Potter basically only has his scenes with Radar through the whole sequence. And of course, yeah, I mean, the very title of the episode, It Happened One Night, is referencing the 1934 Frank Capra film. But yeah, that's the idea, is that, you know, this is just one night at the 477th. And so then at the scene before the final scene of the episode, Hawkeye and BJ and Margaret head back to their respective tents. BJ and Hawkeye notice that Frank has been out all night, and then Margaret comes in her tent and finds that Frank has completely demolished her tent in a way that, you know, again, no one ever would.
Right.
If you were looking for something, you wouldn't trash everything. You would carefully, we see in an earlier scene, he like literally is pulling the boards of her tent apart with a knife. I don't know where he's thinking she's storing all these love notes, whatever. But he trashes the place like the jerk that he is. And she comes back and he's standing there talking about that he needed a pencil. And the episode ends with him just sort of meandering, talking nonsense as she stands there frustrated. And again, I think we're layering in why Margaret eventually leaves Frank in the end of season 4 and the beginning of season 5.
Yeah. They certainly started building up to that at this point.
So overall, for It Happened One Night, I mean, what do you think of this as an episode? Like I said, I think it's a lower gear because it has to be after the dynamic three episodes that preceded it, the three game-changing episodes. So they had to shift down to a lower gear. But when I was reviewing this one for the show, I'd forgotten how funny it is. Like, I laughed out loud many times throughout this episode.
Yeah, it definitely was certainly a funny episode, no doubt about it. There were some good character moments all around, and you're right that after all the excitement of the first couple episodes, they needed a more quieter one just to show so we could get to know especially the new characters a little better. Not that we actually saw much of Colonel Potter, but we did definitely get to see BJ as a new doctor. So that was a good part. Yeah,
it's a building block episode for new characters. I mean, exactly. Really, how it works. So overall, did you have a favorite line or joke from this episode?
The thing that it struck me from when the first time I watched it 40-odd years ago to when I watched it again this weekend was when Klinger ran in to the post op wearing only his underwear. It wasn't even a line, just so the visual image of Klinger running in there in his underwear during the middle of winter, you know, really just breaks me up.
It does look, he sells the freezing really cold. Like, he really sells it quite well. He's like, brr, you know, even with his, as Pod referred to, his thick vicuna coat that Klinger has because of his ethnic background. My favorite joke actually of the episode, like I said, I quoted a bunch of really funny lines, but my favorite joke is, I mentioned the scene earlier where Hawkeye shows up to post-op a couple minutes late. And Frank really gives him all sorts of hell about it. And then Margaret shows up and says, oh, sorry, I'm late. And Frank says, oh, no problem at all, Major. And Hawkeye not looking at either one of them. He can hear all this behind him. He just goes, I had to bring a note from home. I love that he's pointing out the hypocrisy of Frank, that he's mad at Hawkeye for being late. But for Margaret, it's perfectly fine. I really like the annoyed tone that Alan Alda brought to it. So that line made me laugh a lot.
Yeah, that was a very good line. Yeah.
So then that's It Happened One Night. I mean, after the huge episodes that kick off this season, again, they have kind of a quieter one. It's more of a slice of life. And we get to see, you know, how BJ and Potter are operating here at their, no pun intended, at the 477. So it's a very, very funny show. So Ted, thank you so much for doing this. Thank you so much for coming on to MASHcast.
No, definitely glad to be here. Wanted to be on the show ever since it debuted.
Well, again, I'm glad to finally have you on. Why don't you tell people where they can find you on the internet?
Well, I have a number of Twitter feeds. I've got.
Oh, you too?
Yeah. Not, I don't think I've as many as you. I don't know if anybody has as many as you. I've got one under my own name, Ted Kilvington. I've got one that was for my old podcast, Justice Trek. One word, Justice Trek. I also have one that I don't use that much called the Let's Talk Black Hawk Comics.
Mm.
I was a big fan of the Mark Evanier, Dan Spiegel run.
Oh, man, me too.
And that is pretty much it for right now. Focus on, well, mostly my comic collecting at this point. I'm up to about 26,000 original comics now.
Oh my lord. Oh my god. Wow. Where do you store all those comics, Ted? And do you have like a separate vault or what's going on?
I have a 1,000 square foot basement and I bought some shelving units and they're all in either long or short boxes on the shelves. So it's pretty well organized. I do a lot of data work for my day job. So I know how to keep things organized and have spreadsheets that I maintain, what I need and stuff like that.
My goodness. That is just amazing. So, well, again, thank you so much for doing the show. I really appreciate it.
Well, definitely glad to be here, and I hope to come back again someday.
All right, we got 7 more seasons to tackle here on MASH, and that's just counting MASH, not even after MASH. So, of course, everybody, if you want to follow the show on Twitter, you can go to MASH477Cast. All the episodes are on the website, fireandwaterpodcast.com. You can also subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, and Amazon Music. And if you want to support the Fire and Water Podcast Network, go to patreon.com/FW Podcast, and there you can unlock various rewards, one of which is to be name-checked on a show of your choice. So a big salute to Nicholas Prom, Russell Burbage, Stan Peel, Dolph DeVries, Britt Schramm, and Mike Thomas for their support of MASHcast. Very much appreciated. So that is going to do it. There is, as I mentioned at the first episode of the season, there will be occasional break weeks where another show will be running in this time slot. Feels weird to say time slot. We're talking about podcasts. That's sort of how we run things at the network. So next Wednesday, there will be a different show of mine, because I have way too many shows, but I'll have a different show of mine dropping next Wednesday. So there'll be no MASHcast next week, but there will be one 2 weeks after that. So until then, that is all.
Congratulations, you may really be sick.
If you get me well, I'll kid you.
Shut up! You shut up!
You both shut up!
Welcome to One Man's Family.